Well, good morning, everyone. Rich blessings to you as we gather here again to look at another aspect of how to make a school a place where there's a vibrant culture where Christ is honored. I was encouraged with the words this morning already of just recentering ourselves on what God is doing in our midst. And I'd like to review briefly what we covered yesterday, talking about culture and how culture influences a classroom. I realize there's a number of you that are school board members, and maybe you're not in the classroom, but I want to just recap a little bit from yesterday and encourage you that what I have to share today actually influences, you actually have a really big influence in how this gets handled. Because teachers wanting to have a classroom atmosphere of peace, or peacemakers, not just peacekeepers, but peacemakers, those who are actively looking to find peace, that comes from a vision that's higher up than just the teacher, and there needs to be a support for that. And so I just invite all of you to dig in, see what God has for us here. So yesterday we took a look at a culture, and I asked the question, what is culture? And one of the ways that we answer that is culture is the way we do things around here, or culture is the way things are. When you go somewhere, what you see is what you get. That's the culture. But there often is a subculture. There is a written culture. Maybe you have a handbook or a policy book or something, and that's how you intend to be. And that is the vision you have. But sometimes the subculture is what's actually happening, and they're not always completely aligned. A classroom and a school has a culture. Even if it is unspoken, even if it isn't all written down, you still have a culture. And it is shaped more by what's caught than taught. There's a lot of things we teach in books, but there's a lot of things that are also caught by the way they take, by the way the teachers handle the classrooms, by the way the leadership leads in the school. And I think our Christian culture, the culture we want to encourage in our schools, should be shaped by Christ's values. And we want to have grace, humility. We want to have the truth of God's word honored. We want Christ's love to be there, and we want peace to be there. And so we took a look at the image of a tree, and we also saw the cutaway where we could see the root system. And we said the tree, the fruit, the leaves, the branches on the top, that's what you can see. But what is causing what you see? Because you could have a healthy tree or you could have an unhealthy tree. And you have to look down below the ground where the root system is, and you look at what's going on there. What are the values, the beliefs, the stories, the traditions, the rituals that shape the very tree that is growing? And we talked about how every teacher creates culture. Culture is not something that you just change in a day. And I kind of encourage new teachers when they go to a new place to really try to learn from the culture. It's easy for us to be used to doing something the way we were always used to doing it, and we go elsewhere and they do it so differently, and we just think our way sure was better than this way. But just allow yourself to kind of blend in and learn from the culture before trying to change everything. Some things take years to change, and other things can be changed in 30 seconds by your presence and by the way you handle the situation. And I think the topic today is more one of the things that you can do by just the way you are. And most importantly, we talked about the teacher must be connected to Christ. And if there's a grounding in Christ, that's when you have the best ability and best chance to actually carry on the vision and create a culture that honors Christ. I would like to transition that a little bit, and let's take a look at Psalm 86, just a few verses to start us off here. Psalm 86, verse 6. This is a prayer of David, and I'm not really reading everything. It's a beautiful prayer. But I do notice a little bit that some of his prayer is, he is talking about some tension going on. And then he flips over and he stops thinking about the tension, and he just says, look, I'm praying to God. I know God will take care of me, and I can just fully trust him. And then the next thing he says, these enemies, and he talks about the tension again. And then he goes back to praising God because he knows that when we call to God, we know that he will come out for us, right? So verse 6, listen closely to my prayer, O Lord. Hear my urgent cry. I will call to you whenever I'm in trouble, and you will answer me. There's that deep confidence. I can trust in God. And then I will slip all the way down to verse 14 and read to the end. I'm reading in the NLT. O God, insolent people rise up against me. A violent gang is trying to kill me. You mean nothing to them. But you, O Lord, are a God of compassion and mercy, slow to get angry and filled with unfailing love and faithfulness. Look down and have mercy on me. Give your strength to your servant. Save me, the son of your servant. Send me a sign of your favor. Then those who hate me will be put to shame. For you, O Lord, help and comfort me. I'd like us to think that when there's tension, to not think that the people in our lives are the gang that's trying to kill me. Rather, you and your friend or enemy, whatever you call this person at the point when you're having a tense moment, there's some conflict, think you have a common enemy, but the other person is not the enemy. And if you can remember that the people in your life are not your enemies, but you together have a common enemy who is trying to destroy the relationship between the two of you. And if we can remember that the heart of God is to be compassionate and to be slow to anger, to give mercy again, and to give another opportunity. And that is what I'd like for all of us to adopt. When we see tension and conflict in our classrooms, what is the attitude that we portray as we go in and we try to negotiate between these? Are we able to have that same compassion that God has? So, yesterday I mentioned that the vision behind a school influences the school culture a lot. And for those of you who are school board members, I want to thank you specifically for the way you invest in two things. Because what is a school board? A school board is somebody who has been commissioned by the church to carry out the church's wishes. They own the vision. The Brotherhood had a vision, and the school board has commissioned, here, we want you to own this. We want you to make this come to fruition. And then they take it from there, and they make things happen. But often the school board is not actually involved in the day-to-day actions of what happens in school. So the school board actually has to have a really clear vision and then be able to communicate that clearly and delegate that clearly and effectively. And so I want to specifically thank you that you are men of vision and that you've been willing to listen to the Brotherhood and you've been willing to try to capture what will serve this church the best. And then you've tried to put that into shoe leather and you've tried to hand that off to somebody who will be there day in and day out and you can trust them. The task that you as school board members have to find the right person to fill the seat of teaching and to carry that vision. And so often what you do is you find a teacher from another community. They don't even know your church. And so you're actually acting on a lot of trust. And you're interviewing these people, and you really hope that when this new person from another community comes here, I can effectively communicate to them what I want, and my church will be behind them because they trust that I've put somebody in the place that will actually do a good job. So this is a lot of synergy happening, right? And there's certainly room for conflicts to arise. But when the Lord is present, I'm just humbled to see that whole picture can work out so well when the Lord is present. Okay, conflicts. Conflicts will happen. In Joshua 22, we have this vivid picture of how assumptions can lead to serious tensions. We'll read a few verses here if you want to turn there. But I'll be recounting just a little bit of the story. Joshua 22. And we'll start in 11. But before we start reading here, you remember how the children of Israel, when they finally got to Canaan, there were a few of the tribes who were staying on the east side of the Jordan River. And they had their land, and then the men had to, they left their cattle and their families behind, and the men had to go across Jordan and continue to fight and conquer the rest of Canaan while that was happening. They needed to stick with them, right? But when all that happened and they were done, and these tribes went back across the Jordan River, and they went back to their home, the first tribes that were on the other side of the Jordan, they set up a big altar, and they were sacrificing. And the tribes on the other side, they looked across the river and said, what is going on over there? Why are they offering an altar over there? And they started creating stories that weren't verified, and they said, this is a bad deal. They are offering sacrifices to the wrong God. We have to go deal with these people. And so they came across armed and ready to fight. And they get there, and let's take a look here. Joshua 22, verse 11 and 12. The rest of Israel heard that the people of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh had built an altar at Gilaloth at the edge of the land of Canaan on the west side of the river. So the whole community of Israel gathered at Shiloh and prepared to go to war against them. And when they came across, this group said, hang on, we want you to know that we serve the same God. And we want you to know that there's a reason why we built this altar. So down in verse 22, this is how the people of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh responded. The Lord, the Mighty One, is God. The Lord, the Mighty One, is God. He knows the truth, and may Israel know it too. We have not built the altar in treacherous rebellion against the Lord. If we have done so, do not spare our lives this day. If we have built an altar for ourselves to turn away from the Lord, or to offer burnt offering or grain offerings or peace offerings, may the Lord himself punish us. The truth is, we have built this altar because we fear that in the future your descendants will say to ours, what right do you have to worship the Lord, the God of Israel? The Lord has placed the Jordan River as a barrier between our people and you, people of Reuben and Gad. You have no claim to the Lord, so your descendants may prevent our descendants from worshiping the Lord. So we decided to build the altar, not for burnt offerings or sacrifices, but as a memorial. It will remind our descendants and your descendants that we too have the right to worship the Lord at his sanctuary with our burnt offerings, sacrifices, and peace offerings. Then your descendants will not be able to say to ours, you have no claim in the Lord. And I'll just stop reading there. There was a desire to worship the Lord, but they were misunderstood. And I want to just help us think that very many times the conflicts that arise are actually from misunderstandings. And if we're willing to take the time to listen, conflicts could probably be avoided or at least brought to peace. But if we don't learn to listen, and this is often the hard part, the taking the time to listen and asking proper questions rather than jumping to conclusions can really help a lot. Conflict resolved through proper dialogue and with empathy honors God. So, in your classrooms, now speaking to the teachers specifically, what types of conflict do children often face? Can you think of a situation where you've seen conflict? I can think of a number of different things, but probably in the playground is most common, right? And there may be other places. I'm thinking of teenage girls and discovering that maybe they don't all feel like best friends anymore. And sometimes you have exclusion. Sometimes you have boys who have big egos and they really think that they should be able to speak their mind, and the other person thinks that they should also be able to speak. You have all kinds of things. In some cases, we have bullying. We have words that hurt that shouldn't have been said, right? Misunderstandings, competition. And as we interact with these children, we have a duty to help them navigate through those kinds of conflict. But where does this conflict come from? Conflict always is centered in our self-centeredness. We are right, or we look out for ourselves, and then often we have unmet desires. We have a certain desire, or we might even have idols of the heart, and they cause us to become self-centered and selfish. But before I say that all conflict is wrong, I would like to also mention that there are good desires. And sometimes when people have a good desire and they want to stand up for what's right, it can also cause conflict. And we know that we as people are worshipers. We worship God or we worship something else, right? And even children are worshipers. And every fight that flows from a heart is wanting something else, right? Is wanting something. And so I'd like for us to kind of picture a dinner table. You have a dinner table at your house, and you might have a number of different personalities at the dinner table. They come to sit down, and I'm going to picture the one side of the conversation as being more of a minimizer. When something comes up, it's kind of a conflict issue, they tend to minimize things and they back up their chair and they get further away from the table. Okay? And then you have those who are more confrontational. They're in for the debate. Like, they do debates just for fun. I mean, it's they don't have a problem digesting their food while they're having a debate. They just go for it. And so as soon as a little debate comes up, they're like almost on the table and they are in your face. And if you have two sides, if you have a minimizer on one side and a confrontationalist on the other side, it doesn't work very well. And if you have both sides being confrontationalists, they'll be at each other. They'll be like almost on the table together, okay? And if you have minimizers on both sides, they'll both be quiet. And they'll just both stop talking. So we have different ways of handling conflict. Another way to explain this is the minimizer might be an escape route. The person chooses to run away or just use the blame game. They don't want to take the blame. Or they might deny that anything is happening. And then on the other side, where the confrontation is happening, there's the attack method. And they'll do put-downs. They might use gossip. They might start fighting. And so the one side is very different than the other side. But what would it be like for them to come to the table and feel comfortable staying close to the table? What does it take? What can you put at the center of the table that will cause both the attacker and the escaper want to stay and want to really engage in the situation? And I used the word yesterday, if you remember the word curiosity. If both of the people can use curiosity while at the table, because think about this. The one who wants to debate and is confrontational, if usually they're just making their statements and they're trying to come at it one way or another way to win, right? They will win the conversation. So if that person took on the aspect of, I'm really curious what your perspective is, and they don't say their opinion first, but they allow for the other person to have space to talk. Okay, now the person who wants to escape and minimize and back away, well, it's not near as bad because they're asking me a question. And when you ask a question, it draws them back to the table to where they can talk about it. And so what does it look like? Sometimes when you're at the middle of the table, you have a way to work it out. And for children, it's healthy to talk about it. But for children, often they don't want to talk about it. They want to either clam up or they will just throw gossip or put downs. They don't want to really ask questions and walk in the other person's shoes for a while. And so for us as teachers, what can we do? We can help children learn some words that they can use to learn to talk about it. And if they don't know how to talk about it, they can learn to go get help. They could go to somebody that could help them. And sometimes it's minor things, right? But we carry these minor things for a long time. Sometimes it's helpful for them to learn to overlook things and just move on. But can we use curiosity? Can we help both sides to bring more of a curious perspective? So the side that's minimizing or trying to escape, what if they stop feeling like they're just being attacked and actually also ask some curious questions? Because the debater really needs somebody to debate against. So if you throw another accusation or another opinion really strong against the debater, you're just going to fire up and he's going to keep going, right? But if the minimizer can just ask a curious question, all of a sudden it kind of cools the fire down and the other person can talk maybe more logically rather than trying to convince so hard. And both sides benefit a lot from being curious. It works in different ways, but it draws them together, brings them back to the table. Matthew 5 verse 9, we are taught that blessed are the peacemakers. And I think if we adopt this method of having a curious mindset where we're willing to engage, but not to fix people, but rather to hear them out, that's when we're being peacemakers. We give a space where people can talk about what's going on inside. What are some steps that we could help young people, our children in our schools, learn the steps of making peace? I have four steps here that I'd like to go over. And I'll have the acronym first. They all start with a G. And then I'll have the practical part and how it works out. So glorify God. When you come to a situation where there's some tension, or your students do, is the first thing you think of to glorify God? Usually that's not very close to my mind. It's actually kind of far removed. I want us to encourage, well, I encourage you as teachers, step number one, say, I want to glorify God. Well, how do you do that? Well, you pause. The practical step is you just pause, you breathe for a little bit, you breathe a prayer, and you remember, okay, look, it's not that important. I want God to be glorified. I don't have to be right in the situation. And so teaching children to breathe, if they're really, really angry or something, teach them to count to 10 before they say something. And then maybe ask a question, what is really going on? Instead of just doing the first thing that comes to their mind. So step number one is to glorify God or to pause. Second, from the biblical perspective, get the log out. So often we see something in the other person's eye, but we don't realize that we have a whole log in our own eye. And what that really means is you have to own it. You have to own the fact that I also have something that's causing part of this tension. And owning up to my own mistake and saying, I shouldn't have done this, even if it wasn't my, like I didn't start it or whatever, children always want to point out, look, it wasn't my fault. It's not even, you should be talking to them like I didn't do it first or whatever, but own it. Like you just have to come to a place where you take full responsibility for yourself. I was trying to, or I shouldn't have a child or have yourself get in a posture where you own what your own mistake is. And then gently restore. We speak wise words. We speak truth statements. And it's really helpful if we can teach our children, and even if you can teach yourself, to learn to communicate without making a strong accusation. Because sometimes when somebody does something to me, it's very easy for me to make a complete judgment and I say, you were mean to me, or you have a jealousy problem and I just blame you and I label you with something. What I should rather say is, I felt this when you did this because. Now, if I feel something, then I'm not just labeling you and blaming you for a certain thing. I'm saying this is how it felt to me. Maybe that's not what you intended, but that's how it felt to me. Okay, so now I'm communicating from my heart rather than putting a lot of blame on you that may not actually be true, right? And sometimes when we're hurt, we assume things that the other person intended that might not actually have been the case. And then finally, go and be reconciled. Make it right. How do we make things right? Do you know how to model making things right with children? If you want to make something right, you really have to admit first and apologize. You have to admit the fact, then you make the apology statement. You have to accept the way things are. You can't always change things. And then you have to ask for forgiveness, and you have to be willing to change your ways, to alter your ways. So these are five A's: admit, apologize, accept, ask, and alter. Am I willing to admit my mistake, apologize for what I did, accept the way things are, and then ask for forgiveness and alter my ways. What are some things we can do that could prevent conflict and bring a peaceful culture in our classrooms? I think it's very helpful if the teachers can talk about situations when the heat is not there. If you have a situation on the softball diamond and there's name calling or there's very strong words and the feelings are all hot, and you try to right there and then try to fix these two who are at each other, it's going to be very hard, because you might be able to stop them from yelling at each other, but you might not reach their heart. And sometimes it's helpful for them to just cool down for a little bit. And at another time, when that kind of is already in their past memory, bring it up when you're inside, maybe before you go to recess next time. And you might go to the whiteboard and say, hey, I'd like to just point something out. When these situations come up, and you do a little bit of a role play, or you model for them, or you might point out to them, what is a healthy way to respond? Because very often you'll notice it once or twice, and say, okay, there's a certain kind of verbiage being used, or there's a two or three people that use this particular argument, and it's not hard for you to figure out, okay, this is I can see where this is going. And sometimes you can actually use, see, sometimes you can use in the classroom, you can use the words that you heard in the playground. And you say, sometimes I hear you using these words. Let me give you some ideas of how you could say it. Now you're giving them ideas for adult words to use, rather than just coming to the conflict and they use whatever words comes out. And if you can provide a little bit of a script for how they can more respectfully say something, and then when the situation comes up again, they may start using their words, but you can remind them, hey, could you use the other words? And they'll remember, because they've heard them before. They might have even said them before, because you asked them to say them in the classroom as a practice. And now you can help them model, and they remember because they've practiced it once before. Practicing with children is very, very helpful. And we can often help them, teach them how to ask for help. Sometimes they don't know how to ask for help. We can also teach them how to listen well. Sometimes they hear something, but they don't respond from what they heard. And teaching them how to do active listening. And also to teach them how to disagree respectfully. How to give the other person space and be okay with them not coming to terms immediately. I like to think of our recess times especially as a space where our character is tested. One of my co-teachers went to visit a charter school in Cleburne one time. And as he was interacting with the principal at the charter school made a comment. He said, our recess is where we build conflict resolution skills. He had a clear purpose of what the reason was for recess. And in our schools, maybe sometimes we think about that, but we more think of it as being a little bit of a break or give a little bit of a diversion from the studies. But what if you actually begin to welcome the moments of conflict and you say, you know what, every conflict that comes into my classroom where my students are interacting with somebody else and there's conflict, what if that was a God-given opportunity for you to model and teach them at a very young age what it looks like to live like a peacemaker? We wish, I know all of you teachers, we wish there was no conflict in our classrooms. But we would miss a lot of opportunities at a very young, formative age where these children can actually adopt and see what it looks like to live like peacemakers. And if we don't learn it when they're young, I don't know when they're going to learn it, right? Paul David Tripp talks about five questions that he uses. These questions can be very, very helpful for teachers if you have to have a conversation after a problem arose. And I'm going to give these questions to you and then recount the story that Paul uses along with it. Question number one, and the context here is these are questions that form the heart, instead of just stopping a conflict. Number one is, what happened? What's going on here? Question number two, after they tell you what happened, You can ask the question, what were you thinking or feeling? And if I ask that question, where is that, what part of the person are we talking to? We're going to the heart, right? We're saying, what was your heart thinking or feeling? And then after you ask, what were you thinking or feeling, you say, and then what did you do? So something was happening, they felt something, and then they did something. What did you do? And then you can ask another question, and this one's very revealing, and it teaches the child that they are learning that these things are from the motives of their heart. They didn't do it out of a vacuum. There's something inside of me that causes me to do it. And this question is, why did you do it? What was the motive or the desire of your heart for doing what you did? And number five, what was the result? So Paul tells the story of his two toddlers. He had two boys, and one was three, the other one was barely two, I think. And they were playing together. The older brother had a big Tonka truck, and the younger brother wanted to play with the Tonka truck. And he grabbed it and took off with it. And big brother, three-year-old, comes over and grabs the Tonka truck and beats the brother over the head. And so now they're in trouble. And so now the dad is having this conversation with the three-year-old. And he asks, what was going on here? And he says, I want my Tonka truck. And then he just asks the little boy, what were you thinking? My truck. Okay, so you see that little bit of my heart? My heart says I'm selfish. My truck. And what did you do? Hit him. And why did you do it? Well, there was anger, right? There was selfishness. And he mentioned my truck again, but it was coming from because I'm angry. I want my stuff. And so what happened now? Trouble? Okay, and so you see very quickly, even at a very, very young age, you can begin to help a child realize that they got into trouble, but it actually came from deep inside of their heart. And you have to help them recognize that it's the heart that causes us to do things. And we want transformation, like we heard this morning. We want our children to learn in a way that will cause them to grow, that will cause them to recognize that my heart is actually selfish. It needs to be transformed by Christ. And we teach that through the teachings of Christ. So, your classroom culture is actually shaped by conflict. And the conflict is not always a problem. The conflict can be a problem, but can you welcome it? Can you adopt a perspective that the conflict that comes to my classroom can actually be a tool to bring Christ's peacemaking skills into our classroom? We are called to be peacemakers, not just peacekeepers. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the children of God. Romans 14:9. Let us therefore make every effort to do what leads to peace and to mutual edification. And this is in the context of that sharp division in Romans, where the Jewish Christians and the Gentile Christians were at odds with each other about what kind of foods can you eat, what kind of foods can you not eat, and what kind of holidays can you keep. And there was that sharp division going on, and Paul says, let us therefore make every effort to do what leads to peace and to mutual edification. Paul had a really optimistic perspective in the face of a conflict in a church that could have caused great division. And I find that encouraging, because if Paul could have the courage and the optimism to bring Jews and Gentiles together in one church house and see them come to peace, and he thought it was possible, then I believe we have a lot of reason to believe that we can teach conflict resolution skills and bring peace to our own classrooms. Our students are watching and learning from our ways of dealing with conflict every day. And I'd like to encourage us to build classrooms where conflict becomes a door of growth, not a wall of division. We'll pause for prayer. Father, I thank you for each of these teachers that you have called to shape the hearts and minds of children. Bless them with your wisdom when conflict arises. Give them compassion, humility, and patience. and show them how to model peacemaking so that we can reflect Christ as we build a culture that honors you. In Jesus' name, amen.